Here we are on Blogging Heads, myself and Sarah Lacey. So we're going to have this conversation. We started the conversation 2 weeks ago on NBC's show Press Here, and the question is whether there's a lot for the internet to learn from previous new media of the 20th century. My new book, The Master Switch, argues that we should look to radio, we should look to the film industry, we should look to the telephone industry to understand what happened to them. And see whether that is also going to be the destiny of the internet. And I'm suggesting in the book that there was a period of openness that led afterwards to increasing consolidation and monopolization and integration. And Sarah, why don't you tell me why I'm wrong?
Well, I'm not sure you're wrong because it seems like you kind of hesitate before jumping off the cliff of, yes, this will happen to the internet. You just say, well, it could. And it's like, and so I agree
Right.
with you, it could. I don't think it will, for two reasons. One is just the nature of the internet itself. I mean, it's somewhat self-disrupting because it's so open and because it's a technology that's being sort of explored globally at the same time and doesn't really
Right.
have borders the way, film or music did. I mean, even online music and movie companies you can't have access to in other countries. Like every other version of communication was sort of more necessarily limited at borders, either because of technology or copyright issues. And so I think
Right.
that the inherent openness of the web itself is one thing that's important. I think if it started to get closed, people would just start another web. I think beyond that, though, there's this issue of the community and sort of the machine around startups. And it's not that there weren't entrepreneurs in those earlier days. I just
Right.
think modern entrepreneurship is a very different thing now. And it's based on this system of $20 billion a year in venture capital and an army of people, I mean, like me at TechCrunch, and lawyers and accountants and admins and bankers whose entire income and entire profession is based on smart kids coming up with new ideas in the internet and disrupting the giants. And I think the existence of Facebook proves it. I think if we were supposed to, if it was following the same path as those earlier ones, the giants would be AOL, Yahoo, eBay, and they're not. Those companies are all struggling.
Right. Well, I take that argument. Let's start on the finance issue. The truth is that money will support winners, period. And it has been true that over the last 10 or 15 years, there's been a lot of money to be made backing startups, since the mid-90s. But you have to admit it's true that maybe the markets will start to understand if monopoly ends up being, if the winners are the larger companies. It's certainly got to be possible that the money will start going towards the large dominant firms. And when you look at the stock market, the venture capitalist is another issue, but the stock market certainly rewarded the dominant companies. Google, Facebook hasn't been rewarded yet, but they have certainly not punished the monopolists. And if that seems to me to indicate they think that these companies will survive and continue to prosper. Now,
So,
maybe, well, go ahead.
well, I should say, I don't disagree with you. I actually think the stock market is making this worse because the stock market is getting more and more obsessed with large cap companies and less into small cap. And a lot of that is like the changes in banking regulation, post Enron, post the 2000 bust. The fact that all these small boutique banks in Silicon Valley that were really championing small disruptive companies all got acquired by these big bulge bracket firms. I mean, I think. Like, you're absolutely right that Wall Street wants the easy. I make the investment in Google, my internet sector is covered, bet.
Right.
And if we were only talking about the stock market, then I would agree with you. But, I think you have to look at where the money is flowing. So, America has this huge hoard of all of this retirement, pension, 401k money, and increasingly it's been flowing into venture capital. And before the last couple decades, like before the Glass-Steagall change in regulation, institutions couldn't invest in venture capital. So it's not just that venture capital has gotten better, it has systemically changed in the last couple of decades so that, it is no longer an asset class where you have to rely on wealthy individuals who've made some money, putting in a million or so over a couple companies. You now have every major institution in the world that has, between 2 and 10% of their asset allocation going into it. So it's almost like you've created a whole nother stock market that's
Right.
doing the job that the big stock market
No,
doesn't. And it's only based on new entrants disrupting the old. That is the only way it makes money.
Well, it's not. That's actually not true, though. That's the problem. Is it's not only based on new entrants disrupting the old. It's also based on the idea that you might get acquired. And I think the acquisition side it needs to be thought. Whether we think acquisitions are actually, I mean, a lot of the venture capital financing, that the dream, sometimes it is the dream to be the disruptor of what was before. Mm-hmm. But sometimes the dream these days is like, you'd say like YouTube, great example, is to get acquired.
Right.
And if the dream, if the idea of venture capital financing be, but we want to find people who are going to get acquired by one of the big companies, well, we're not really talking about a deeply disruptive world. And in fact, you could see a world where venture capital increasingly believes that each job is to fund little companies that will eventually be bought by one of the big three or the big four of the internet. What I'm really talking about is not, you know, so much a crazy monopoly like an empire in the nature of AT&T. I think that's less likely. I do think there is a possibility of something like the car industry in the 20th century, where it became the big three.
Well, so I think the acquisition point is a really good one. And I mean, it's odd that I'm even in this debate defending venture capitalists, because I've been attacking the industry for not taking enough risk, like for most of the last 5 years.
Right.
And, you know, when my book publishes in January, we can come back and debate that. But it's, you know, I do agree with you that there's a very strong strain in Silicon Valley that's going more and more towards acquisition and less away from taking these big risks and building these big home runs. But that's actually less the venture capitalists, and it's more these so-called super angels, these small
right.
funds that are out seeding things. That and what they're doing is they're saying, you know, you're building a product, basically, not a company, and it gets a lot of traction for very cheap, and then you flip it for, you know, anywhere between, you know,
right.
$1 million to $50 million to one of the big three. And there are people who think that is the future of this industry. And I've argued very hard that if that's the future of the industry, Silicon Valley is falling off a cliff, because
right.
it's always been
right.
based on big home runs. And it's somewhat obvious that if you aren't building the next Google, then there's no one to acquire all of these smaller companies, and it just goes away. So I think there's a bigger problem if we go towards that. But
right.
that having been said, the venture capitalists actually are the ones who are really fighting that trend, because
right.
their business has to have home runs. They will not. Their economics won't work on flipping
mm-hmm.
things for $50 million
mm-hmm.
or less. So you see examples like Mint.com, which was, I think, the quickest benchmark has ever had a return on its money of a certain multiple, like in the history of the fund. I mean, it was started,
right.
it was built, it was bought by Intuit in, I think, something like 18 months. And, you know,
right.
it's a great
no.
success
okay,
story, but all of the VCs were trying to talk Aaron Patzer out of selling. They were trying to talk him out of selling, because they know their business will fall off the cliff. So again, I think you have to delineate the different factions in Silicon Valley. I think entrepreneurs want quick flips. I think angels do. But VCs are just as scared of that as I am.
Right. Well, let me bring up another few things about the venture capital, which you obviously look at it more carefully. I'm looking at the 200-year picture. But there's two things that also strike me that could happen that would make this industry, again, and my thesis is that basically like the car industry in the 1920s or 30s, into a big three, where it's all about big three as opposed to disrupting existing models. And that is, first of all, that venture capital may go elsewhere. I mean, venture capital may stay around, but it might not be in the internet industry anymore. So I don't know what, it's hard to name what the other industry, maybe children's toys or something, or I don't know what.
I don't know
what would it be, but you know, there's a possibility that there will still be venture capital, but they just won't be quite as interested. Or it's some other part of tech,
mm-hmm.
Which also,
yeah. Well, there's
I don't
a lot
know
of people
name.
Who argue
yeah.
clean tech would be, you know, the next big thing. But the problem is VCs have gotten so addicted to this kind of like of the internet. It is so easy to put something
right.
out there and see if you have something, versus biotech or clean tech, where you have to
right.
do like 10 years of research. And you know, I just think that the industry sort of doesn't have the stomach to take risk to do things that are going to take that long and cost that much money. You know, I think the other thing to look
right.
at is this global issue, because, I mean, I know you made the point in our show that, you know, the internet being bigger in China than America is, you know, not necessarily a good thing for openness. But there is a
right,
culture in China of no one sells to bigger companies. Like none of the big internet
right.
companies buy any smaller companies. And culturally, it's like it was in the 90s in Silicon Valley, where everyone wants to go public. So even if, you know, and I think that's going to spread to India. I think it's going to spread to Brazil. We're already seeing that a bit in Russia. So, I mean, I think the global phenomenon of this is a little bit of a hedge to even everything you're saying,
yeah.
you know, coming true here.
Well, let me hold on to the global part. I want to stay with venture capital industry for one more point. The other thing that's getting a lot of funding are, of course, apps. Let's say Foursquare, for example. Mm-hmm. And when you think about those companies, they are interesting companies, and they're exciting, but they're also not, at some level, fundamentally as disruptive as internet companies. This is a right. little bit of the Chris Anderson web is dead stuff, because you cannot build a Facebook app that destroys Facebook. You cannot, nothing you build on Apple will replace mm-hmm. Apple. So in some ways, the funding of apps fortifies the big players. When you see a lot of funding of app startups, you see a fortification of the main platforms.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good point. And again, that's another thing that I've been really critical on in Silicon Valley is this obsession with just doing these app companies, because there's just I'm not one of those reporters who gets super excited about technology and features for the sake of technology and features. I get really excited about right. disruptive businesses. And by their definition, you're right. They're really not right. disruptive businesses. I mean, maybe with the exception of Zynga, which actually has built something that is making more money than some of the platforms it's right. running on. But they're exceptions. But I think what you have to remember is, like, this is such a scale game. And it's such a game of that 1 out of 1,000 home run company that, you know, that builds something really huge and who has the stomach to build something really huge. Right. I mean, you know, you look at Facebook, and I know it's bad to just say, oh, another Google or another Facebook, because it's like, what are the odds right. another one comes along, you know, like next week? Right. I mean, they're rare by their definition. But, you know, it wasn't just that Mark was building something that wasn't an app or was an app. It was that he didn't want to sell, and he didn't, you know, and he did right. did the most illogical thing at every turn for this company. I mean, in the early days, every advertiser wanted you to maximize time spent on site. And Mark was like, and that's why and page views. And that's why, like, on MySpace, it took you like 45 minutes to add a friend. And, you know, Mark was like, no, I want people to be able to get in and out. And I just want them to come back frequently. And everyone was like, that's outrageous. How are you going to build a business around that? But he didn't care. And, you know, when it right. started taking off and he was offered $1 billion by Yahoo, you know, he opened that board meeting by looking at the clock and saying 8:30 is as good as time to turn down $1 billion as any. I mean, there are just few entrepreneurs who are going to do that. And to me, like, that's what we're talking about. Like, that's the thread of Silicon Valley entrepreneurship. And it's crazy and it's not rational. And it's done by really arrogant, really cocky people. And those people have always existed throughout disruption. But they're put right, into a true. Framework where there is $20 billion seeking these people, like heat-seeking missiles. Let us give you this money. Let us make you into a company. And I just think the law of averages says that when you have that strain of people, when you have an ecosystem that not only rewards it, but goes after them and tries to force them to build big companies, I just think it's a different paradigm. And the odds that everyone will just build something on top of something else and that ecosystem will just allow the big three to dominate it, you know, that seems a crazier supposition to me.
But that same personality trait you're talking about, which I agree, is that strange, kind of uninterested in money. There's a famous economist named Joseph Schumpeter who wrote a book in 1910 about these people, about exactly people. And he said, you know, kind of in our population, like superheroes are these unusual men, very different than the average person. They're like, he compared them to extremely rare opera singers. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, they're not, normal people are interested in money or luxury or the good life. These people want nothing but to found a private kingdom, prove that they are better than other men, and to, you know, luxurious in the domination of their fellow creatures. And there is that personality, and I agree, that is the personality that builds a disruptive company at stage one, but it's also the personality that builds an empire and defends it in stage two. And so if, I'm saying, the fact that personality trait hasn't changed could suggest that we end up with, as I said again, a big three or a big four that stick around longer than we expect right now. I'm equivocating, but, you know, since we're supposed to be arguing, I'm going to just say it. I will be surprised. I'm going to say that 5 years from now, we'll look back and we'll say, wow, what happened? You know, we really thought this was going to be but the people who were the disruptors managed to get their empires and held on, and now we really just think of the internet as the big three or the big four with a couple, you know, with some gravy.
I mean, so, okay, so if you're right, then why is Yahoo – dead? I mean, why has Yahoo fallen off a cliff? Why has eBay fallen off a cliff? Why is, I mean, no offense to my overlords who just bought TechCrunch, but why is AOL a shadow of its former self? I mean, you have something you cannot deny that has happened throughout the history of the web, where companies cannot stay the dominant company for more than 4 or 5 years, and then they start this decline, and they can't seem to pivot into the next thing. You know, Yahoo could not make the switch from directory focused search to algorithm search. Google is trying desperately to make the switch from all algorithm to somehow human powered things. Both by acquiring YouTube, which is social. You know, now maybe acquiring Groupon, trying to build its own sort of gaming thing to compete with Facebook. I mean, it's not happening now. So why would we look back 5 years ago, from 5 years from now, and see it? Is it going to be Facebook? Because Google's already struggling.
Well, this is the problem. I don't think Google's struggling that much, to be honest. And that's a very inside the valley view. Mm-hmm. And I think looking at 15 years of history is inadequate. There's often, it's only 15 years we've been here. And yes, there's some of the early companies failed. That's true. But if you look at, say, any other industry over this time period, from the invention of the new thing, let's say the car or in my book, a film, there is this kind of widowing out period where someone seems really dominant at the beginning and then kind of fades. In film, for example, the Thomas Edison Company ruled film, the very, very early film before Hollywood rose. And the question is, when does the sort of mature version of the industry arrive? And I guess what I'm saying is Yahoo, eBay, all these other things were kind of the very, very early. I mean, eBay was a big company, Yahoo, 1 or 2 years after the internet arrived on the desktop. So the chance of them getting it right is pretty low. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if Facebook and Google and Apple have it right, but they're getting closer. And I'm suggesting that there may be an evolution 2, 3, and I don't know if it's these three, but towards a holding pattern of 3 or 4 really, really big companies that are the platforms. And I would bet on them. And I don't want to say 100%, but it could be a future where it is Google, Facebook, Apple. And maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they'll get destroyed in 5 years. But I think they're in a much better holding pattern than the company like eBay ever was.
Well, I think that we need to delineate between the mobile web and the computer-based web, because I agree with you much more on the mobile web, because that's where, there really is sort of a stranglehold, and you kind of have to go through Google, you have to go through Apple. I mean, it seems to me the paradigm you're describing, we're already seeing in early days being built much more on these smartphones than on the web itself. Do you see a big difference between the two?
No, I agree with you. I mean, it's the most obvious. This trend I'm talking about has happened if the platforms that matter become tablets and mobile. And the main reason is that's much more gatekeepered up, shall we put it. You have to work through some platform owner. So, yeah, it's definitely a much more powerful. But the move, or a lot of things are moving away from the computer. It goes along with this tendency of moving away from the computer as a dominant device towards phones and tablets. And if that trend continues, it tends to fortify what I'm suggesting.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel about Google being one of those players? Because, obviously Apple is not an open company. And it's a company that, as you talked about before, really prizes great user experience, great devices, ease of use, and you give up openness in order to get those things.
Right. That's right.
But
That's
is
right.
that do you think Google will be the same with Android? Are you as concerned?
that's an interesting question. So Google is the interesting company because it's trying to do something which has never been done in history, which is to remain dominant but stay open.
Mm-hmm.
In the history of communications, once a firm gets big enough, its interests, when it's little, firms tend to like open standards, open protocols, because that's how they get in. That's how they get their start. And so Yahoo loved TCP/IP. All the internet firms love TCP/IP, the internet protocol, because that's how they reached the consumers. They didn't have to do a deal with AT&T or something. But as they get bigger, suddenly closed standards start to seem a lot more attractive because it's a way of keeping away the competitors. So the real question is whether Google, and I guess I'm answering it, the pressure is obvious. The pressure for the firm to be more closed, it may partially explain the closeness of their relationships with Verizon, although they may feel a bit betrayed by that after the whole iPhone situation. But I think that there's an obvious pressure on them to do that. And I think Google themselves are worried about them. I was at Google, I guess, Google DC this week, and they were talking about all the measures they've had to try to prevent themselves from becoming too defensive. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's fascinating to have a firm trying to make itself non-defensive.
I think the biggest concern about Google is if they really start stumbling and if they are no longer, you know, the biggest internet company by market cap and someone really does start, you know, eating into their growth, if Facebook goes public and it's just, you know, catches Wall Street's attention, they come under investor pressure. I mean, that's when, you know, I don't think we've really seen whether Google is evil or not because they haven't been under pressure. And that's when companies are going to do evil things.
Right. Well, that's true. I think that's a good point. Let me turn to your globalization set of questions, whether globalization will keep the internet open or closed. You know, I suggested when we did the TV program that I wouldn't look towards the rest of the world, and I'm curious why you think the rest of the world keeps the internet open. I guess a lot of the world is much more interested in closing the internet than America is.
You think a lot of the world? I mean, other than Russia and China?
Parts of the world. And I guess here's the real big question. It's very interesting to me that we haven't, with one or two exceptions, seen that many really important disruptive companies come out of other parts of the world yet. And I don't want to be like a parochial person. In fact, I'm doing this interview in Canada. But it's interesting. Like, where are you? You go to every country. I don't know if you ever travel, and they're like, "Well, here's our Silicon Valley."
You don't know if I ever travel. I just spent 40 weeks traveling the emerging world looking for high growth entrepreneurs. I know all about your book, and you know nothing about mine. You're such a jerk.
Oh no, we're getting into this, aren't we? All right, so oh yeah, you did. That's true. I know. Okay.
Yes,
so,
I travel.
So yes, you I mean, I don't know if you've been traveling a lot recently, but I wonder if you think that, well, maybe you're the expert on this. Why do you think we haven't seen a really important disruptive firm come out of another country with maybe the exception of Skype? Or have I missed them?
Well, I think you have to specify that you're talking about consumer internet. Because Israel has had a host of incredibly disruptive firms on the enterprise side. You know, I think part of it goes back to what I was talking about how the Valley has this sort of amazing machine of funding and disruption and company formation. Because to be honest, you really see almost all of them out of Silicon Valley. I mean, you haven't seen a lot of them out of LA. Right. You haven't seen a lot of them out of New York. So I think it's less of an America thing, and I think it's more of a Silicon Valley ecosystem something specifically. That having been said, though, I mean, I think we're definitely starting to see them. I think part of the issue is infrastructure in the emerging world. So Western Europe is sort of too fragmented and has a lot of issues, has a lot of cultural issues that are somewhat anti-entrepreneur. And so you always had way more innovation coming out of Israel than you ever had out of Western Europe. But they always did design these companies that were very tailored for America because, you know, there are 8 million people surrounded by hostile neighbors. So I think part of it is like a size and demographic thing when you're going to build something that's really tailored for your own market. So then you got to look at big companies like Brazil, Russia, India, China, Indonesia, and, you know, maybe something sort of regional around Africa or other parts of South America. And I think that you're definitely, I mean, China's ahead of everyone simply because infrastructure is better. I mean, something like 70-75% of people who've been lifted out of poverty in the last 3 decades have all been inside China. So whether or not you want to live in a factory job, they aren't living in slums, you know. So there's more. And then the actual infrastructure in terms of roads, in terms of bandwidth, in terms of people's ability to actually get online, has been built out way more in China than in other countries. So, you know, if you look at China, where there's 400 million people online, India, there's at most 50 million people online. You know, it's not surprising that China has several billion-dollar internet companies and India doesn't. So I think that a lot slower trajectory because they don't have those big local domestic markets yet. And so that means they don't have really easy ways. I mean, the internet is totally a mass game, right? I mean, it's about reaching millions and millions and millions of people. Right. So it's very hard to build a billion-dollar company on the internet that only reaches 40 million people because, you know, you're making money typically off pennies and click-throughs and, you know, small percentages of e-commerce deals. But in right. China, I mean, right. I think China gets a really bad rap for, you know, just being all these, you know, copycats that are ripping off, you know, American internet ideas and localizing them. I think if you actually spend time with a lot of Chinese entrepreneurs and dig into companies like Tencent and Alibaba, you know, in terms of monetization and distribution, which are, you know, kind of the two core things that create an internet company, I mean, Google, that was Google's secret sauce. That's why we're talking about Google, is because they figured out monetization better than anyone else, not necessarily because of their search engine. And I think the Chinese companies have absolutely schooled us on that. Everything Zynga's trying to do, everything with virtual payments, you know, Tencent's the third largest internet company in the mm-hmm. world off of that. They were doing that, you know, back in the early 2000s. So I think China hasn't been doing it, and I think they're just in their first generation now. And so when you see a place that has enough people that they can build these big companies, you know, you're already seeing it. So I think in another 10 years,
the long run, the short run is we're relying on China to keep the internet dynamic and open. That's what I'm hearing you say. I mean, there's
China and venture capitalists, the two boogeymen.
Yeah. No, it's definitely possible that I don't want to be too parochial and say it's possible. It's I think I was going to add to that one of the reasons I think there's problems in other countries, the government is often too interventionist or just generally interest. Governments have changed, but the general tendency is to be more regulatory. And second of all, the incumbent carriers are often just much more in charge of what happens in a way that's hard to explain. Exactly how, in subtle ways. There wasn't the AT&T breakup in most countries that we've had. And the AT&T, my theory, one of the theories in the book, is that basically the AT&T breakup is what led to the internet and computer revolution, is you couldn't have these when AT&T was there. And we have to realize a lot of countries haven't really had the AT&T breakup. England broke up BT eventually, but, you know, it was much, much later. So there is just a greater concentration at the transport layer, which the existence of that idea that it's not completely a free-for-all. I don't know. It's a mystery. It's a mystery. I agree with you, though. There is stuff in China and Israel, and there has been in other countries. But if we're looking for the global internet to sort of save the internet, I'm not sure, or keep the internet divergent and growing and competitive, I guess that's it's a maybe. I'm back to maybe.
Well, I mean, yeah. And I think my point is the same way more companies trying all out for their own selfish interests, all trying to close their network, sort of are natural hedges against each other. I guess my argument is even if every country is trying to control the internet and close the internet and control what's being done on it, it's sort of an analogy. So like all those countries trying to do that as a hedge versus if right. this was just a U.S. dominated technology and the U.S. was trying to control it and the U.S. could control it because the whole thing sort of stopped at the borders of America.
Right.
And I don't know if that makes sense even as an argument, but
yeah, the final argument I guess I'll bring up, which is one that people have made, I'm not sure how right I think it is, but it's one that Jonathan Citrain makes too, is the argument that the U.S. government is itself increasingly interested in a less dynamic, less open internet. The FBI and the Pentagon have become interested in being able to wiretap more stuff, and putting in place those regulations would sort of slow and close things down to some extent. And the whole interest in cyber war, which I don't know why everyone's obsessed with cyber war, but there's this. I think did you hear it on the West Coast? You may not have as many conversations about cyber war.
Yeah, you know, I almost never do, and then it's like I'll reopen the New York Times and there's another thing, and I'm like, wait, what? Really? Again?
There's a whole group of people in Washington who are obsessed with cyber war. It's all they want to talk about. And the latest idea is to blow up WikiLeaks.
Well, then
I don't know why we're laughing. It's not a joke. There's a lot of people. I think the Washington Times said the United States should hone its cyber war capacity and destroy WikiLeaks immediately. But people seem to Wow, it's craziness. The Washington thing around WikiLeaks is pretty crazy, but maybe we could talk about that another time. Anyway, should we close by talking a little?
I want to hear more from you on what you think about the government and if you think the government is going down that path or not. I mean, you're Mr. Net Neutrality, and I think that, you know, I try to spend as little time talking to anyone in D.C. as possible, like most people in Silicon Valley. So, I mean, what do you think the temperature is? I mean,
there is something going on. There's this working group in Washington, which is composed. Working groups are how laws start in Washington. It means a bunch of people from different agencies get together and figure out what the administration wants. And there's a working group which doesn't have, I don't think it has an official name, but basically they're interested in being able to wiretap everything. So it's mostly law enforcement and anti-terrorist groups. So they're saying, you know, we can wiretap phones, that's great, but we need to be able to wiretap Facebook, Gmail, whatever, Twitter. We just need to be able to wiretap everything. We need an easy way to wiretap everything. So if we need to get access to it, I mean, I guess Twitter, you can just look it up.
Right.
But, you know, but Facebook, for example, we need to be able to get people's communications on Facebook, not through a subpoena, but just like snapping our fingers, the way we get a wiretap, right? So we can just listen. Or we need to be able to listen to what people are doing on Facebook or whatever. So the White House isn't too thrilled about this. Some people in the State Department aren't too thrilled. But there is this movement, definitely, to extend wiretapping to every single app, which is some reason what the Obama administration is working on. And I can't say I'm too excited about that movement.
Yeah, that's just horrifying. I mean, I think generally the thing that scares me most, like in order of things that scare me most, I think I'm the least scared about the startup ecosystem in Silicon Valley, because I think even with the move towards acquisition and apps and taking less risk, there are still those crazy outliers, and there is so much money that, you know, is desperate to find them that will, you know, they would have to be, every venture capitalist would have to be an idiot to not hit on one. So, I'm least worried about that. I'm slightly more worried about companies like Google and Apple, because I just don't think it's in their self-interest to be open. So, you know, I'm slightly more worried about that.
Right.
I'm slightly more worried about Wall Street and the role they play in that. I'm slightly more worried about, you know, China, if none of these other nations emerge to have big local internet ecosystems, and then it's just us and China. That's concerning.
Right.
What worries me the most is this government stuff, though, because I think America is just poised to go into, you know, maybe another 40, 50 years of fear. You know, I mean, you have people who, you have people who for the first time, we're not going to have a white male majority in the country, or a white majority. And it's, people are freaked out because they don't know what that means. And you have this, you know, machine around politics that's playing up all those fears. And you have, you know, in the next 40 years, the United States is going to be the only member of the G7 nation that's still one of the largest seven largest economies in the world. So suddenly our economic peers are people like, you know, like China, Indonesia, which is heavily Muslim, which is going to freak people out, Mexico, India, you know, places that people aren't really familiar with and people don't feel as warm and fuzzy about as they do, you know, England and France. So, you know,
I thought you just finished telling me these are the people who are going to save the internet.
Well, yeah, but I'm worried about what Americans are going to do while they're saving the internet.
Right, I
don't have,
so those are the people,
I don't have, see, it's the fear versus the reality. I don't have.
Yeah, so you're the most concerned about the government.
Yeah, so I'm concerned about the government. I'm concerned about those forces in the government.
No, this cyber war stuff.
Playing on these fears.
The cyber war stuff is, it's a weird kind of a hobby of everyone in Washington, like I'm saying, and people keep talking about it. I'm not really sure where it's going, but it sounds kind of cool, so people like to talk about it. I've been to one or two meetings of the Pentagon, and basically we're just talking about it, so no one really knows, but, you know, maybe people want to use these capacities, and therefore they want to harden American, you know, harden the internet against attack, and then, you know, where all of that leads. And so, yeah, that is another underlying threat. Not one that I wrote about in my book, but one which I think is rather interesting.
Perhaps the next
Well, anyway, book. Should we finish with net neutrality? Or
yeah,
are we,
let's talk about net neutrality.
Yeah. Well, look what's going on. It's back in the headlines again. Just a one or two. My only comment, I guess, is that I don't know if you'd talk. Do you want to? I was wondering what you well, I guess I'll talk about what I thought about Julius's new rules. Yeah. I think that Julius's rules, the Julius Jonikowski, the FCC chair, he threw down some new rules, and I have the opinion that they will be modified a bit, that the issue may sort of start to go away after the rules are ratified. The weird thing is that what the rules he's described don't actually make the carriers have to change their conduct at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's no real change in what they have to do. So I don't think they're actually going to – they may complain because they always complain about being, quote, regulated. But when you have a regulation that doesn't make you do anything, that you're not already doing, it doesn't really affect you very much, and so it may just kind of become quiet. That's my prediction, that the rules will pass, and then everything will kind of quiet down.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a weird issue because it's something that people should really care about and be up in arms about, but for whatever reason, it's just not one of those wedge issues that people freak out about. I mean, even when we write about it on TechCrunch for a very tech audience, you know, those aren't the posts that drive tons of traffic. So, you know, there is some sort of complacency on the part of Americans about this issue, and,
right.
You know, I don't really know why, but I could see it kind of going away just because of that, and no one's pushing on it.
Well, it's mostly because the carriers have basically been afraid to really try to break net neutrality because they're afraid of some kind of response. So they haven't, and they're afraid of, they think, even though you think TechCrunch people don't respond that much, they respond more than they do to any other telecom issue. I mean,
yeah.
TechCrunch people, a lot of bloggers are interested in, well, what can my next phone do? What's this cool gadget
that
lets me jump 50 feet in the air? But even a tiny amount of attention to a telecom issue in Washington is unheard of.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many issues, let's say Universal Service Fund, that you never hear about. No one, if even 1% of tech people pay any attention to any issue like net neutrality, for Washington, that's like a rainstorm and everything goes crazy. So I do
think
that
Well, and you have the Pandora effect. I mean, I think we've seen like hints of this just with music online and the degree to which the music industry, you know, gets aggressive enough that services are endangered. I mean, Pandora was basically not killed as a company because it engaged its user base to break Congress's fax machines.
Yeah. No, so it does. By telecom standards, these are very exciting
these
issues.
Are sexy issues.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this: what do you make of this whole Comcast Netflix thing, where basically suddenly Netflix, on a very small percentage of its user base, is consuming so much streaming movies that it's taking like 20% of the bandwidth in evening hours?
Here's the question:
outrageous.
Is that right? The starting point is the starting point is like, what are the facts actually?
So
because the thing is,
I mean, it may be like Obama spending $200 million a day in Indonesia. It's actually based on rupiahs. I don't know.
No, that's the problem. That is the Comcast story. But I don't see what we have to the level three Comcast issue is very simple. The question is it true that, in fact, level three has suddenly put a huge amount of traffic on Comcast networks so that they no longer have a fair agreement? You know, they're peers. They're supposed to trade traffic in a fair way. So is that what's happened? They are just suddenly consuming more, and if you use more, pay more, then Comcast is fine. Or in fact, did they sign a deal with Netflix and immediately did Comcast just dial up their numbers and then say something about, oh, you're going to have a lot more traffic or something like that? We just don't know.
I mean, that's where I tend to get lost in this whole argument anyway. It's unclear to me how unreasonable or reasonable of the telecom companies are being about this, you know, about their bandwidth issues to begin with and the costs.
Well, everyone knows that Comcast wants to kill Netflix, and that's behind. I mean, that's the
for
question.
Other reasons.
So anytime
you
do something that hurts an emergent competitor, and you have an obvious way of killing them, I think you got to take a pretty careful look at that. But if Comcast is right that it's just, you know, they're using a lot more bandwidth, if that's true, it's not just something they're saying. The problem is, it's really hard to figure out what the truth is. And Comcast, they have a good reputation for telling the truth in these areas. In the BitTorrent investigation, they lied to the FCC repeatedly. They have this sort of, you know, and they like to sort of, so what the FCC has to do is someone has to figure out what is actually going on. Because the whole debate is on a set of facts that are assumed one way or another to be true, but no one knows what the actual facts are. So you can't really discuss level three Comcast without understanding what is really going on. Is Comcast suddenly imposing huge fees to try to, for no justification really other than to destroy Netflix? Or is this just a routine billing issue? In which case, then, you know, I'm on Comcast's side. So I just don't think we know the facts. Mm-hmm.
That to me is more scary than anything happening with Google and people building apps for the iPhone.
Yeah.
We'll end on
anyway,
that optimistic note.
Yeah. Let's call it a day. It was fun, Sarah. It's good to see
you.
Yeah,
you too.